From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Leaden Ring. It is not possible, Julia. I cannot conceive how the idea of attending the county ball can have entered your head after what has happened. Poor young Hattersley's dreadful death suffices to stop that. But, Aunt, Mr. Hattersley is no relation of ours. No relation? But you know that the poor fellow would not have shot himself if it had not been for you. Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, how can you say so when the verdict was that he committed suicide when in an unsound condition of mind? How could I help his blowing out his brains when those brains were deranged? Julia, do not talk like this. If he did go off his head, it was you who upset him by first drawing him on, leading him to believe that you liked him, and then throwing him over so soon as the Honorable James Lawler appeared on the tapis. Consider what will people say if you go to the assembly. Well, what they say if I not go. They will immediately send it down to my caring deeply for James Hattersley, and they will think that there was some sort of engagement. They are not likely to suppose that. But really, Julia, you were for a while all smiles and encouragement. Tell me, now, did Mr. Hattersley propose to you? Well, yes, he did, and I refused him. And then he went and shot himself in despair, Julia. You cannot, with any face, go to the ball. Nobody knows that he proposed. And precisely because I do go, everyone will conclude that he did not propose. I do not wish it to be supposed that he did. His family, of course, must have been aware. They will see your name among those present at the assembly. Aunt, they are in too great trouble to look at the paper to see who went to the dance. His terrible death lies at your door. How you can have the heart, Julia? I don't see it. Of course, I feel it. I'm awfully sorry, and awfully sorry for his father, the Admiral. I cannot set him up again. I wish that when I rejected him, he had gone and done as did Joe Pomeroy. Marry one of his landlady's daughters. There, Julia, is another of your delinquencies. You lured on young Pomeroy till he proposed. Then you refused him, and in a fit of vexation and mortified vanity, he married a girl greatly beneath him in social position. If the menage prove a failure, you will have it on your conscience that you have wrecked his life and perhaps hers as well. I cannot throw myself away as a charity to save this man or that from doing a foolish thing. What I complain of, Julia, is that you encouraged young Mr. Pomeroy till Mr. Hattersley appeared, whom you thought more eligible. And then you tossed him aside, and you did precisely the same with James Hattersley as soon as you came to know Mr. Lawler. After all, Julia, I am not so sure that Mr. Pomeroy has not chosen the better part. The girl, I dare say, is simple, fresh, and affectionate. Your implication is not complimentary, Aunt Elizabeth. My dear, I have no patience with the young ladies of the present day, who is shallow, self-willed, and indifferent to the feelings and happiness of others, who craves for excitement and pleasure and desires nothing that is useful and good. Where now will you see a girl like Viola's sister, who let concealment like a worm of the bud feed on her damask cheek? Nowadays a girl lays herself at the feet of a man if she likes him, turns herself inside out to let him and all the world read her heart. I have no relish to be like Viola's sister and have my story a blank. I never groveled at the feet of Joe Pomeroy or James Hattersley. No, but you led each to consider himself the favored one till he proposed, and then you refused him. It was like smiling at a man and then stabbing him to the heart. Well, I don't want people to think that James Hattersley cared for me. I certainly never cared for him, nor that he proposed. So I shall go to the ball. Julia Demont was an orphan. She had been retained at school till she was 18 and then had been removed just at the age when a girl begins to make an interest in her studies and not to regard them as a drudgery. On her removal, she had cast away all that she had acquired and had been plunged into the world of society. Then suddenly, her father died. She had lost her mother some years before, and she went to live with her aunt, Miss Fleming. Julia inherited a sum of about £500 a year and would probably come in for a good estate and funds as well in the death of her aunt. She had been flattered as a girl at home and at school as a beauty, and she certainly thought no small bones of herself. Miss Fleming was an elderly lady with a sharp tongue, very outspoken, and very decided in her opinions. But her action was weak, and Julia soon discovered that she could bend the aunt to do anything she willed, though she could not modify or alter her opinions. In the matter of Joe Pomeroy and James Hattersley, it was as Miss Fleming had said. Julia had encouraged Mr. Pomeroy, and had only cast him off because she thought better of the suit of Mr. Hattersley, son of an admiral of that name. She had seen a good deal of young Hattersley, had given him every encouragement, had so entangled him that he was madly in love with her. And then, when she came to know the lion, James Lawler, and saw that he was fascinated, she rejected Hattersley with the consequences alluded to in the conversation above given. Julia was particularly anxious to be present at the county ball, for she had already been booked by Mr. Lawler for several dances, and she was quite resolved to make an attempt to bring him to a declaration. On the evening of the ball, Miss Fleming and Julia entered the carriage. The aunt had given way, as was her wont, but under protest. For about 10 minutes, neither spoke, and then Miss Fleming said, "Well, you know my feelings about this dance. I do not approve. I distinctly disapprove. I do not consider your going to the ball in good taste, or, as you would put it, in good form. Poor young Hattersley. Oh, dear aunt, do let us put young Hattersley aside. He was buried with the regular forms, I suppose." "Yes, Julia." "Then the rector accepted the verdict of the jury at the inquest. Why should not we? A man who is unsound in his mind is not responsible for his actions." "I suppose not. Much less, then, I who live 10 miles away. I do not say that you are responsible for his death, but for the condition of mind that led him to do the dreadful deed. Really, Julia, you are one of those whose head or heart, only by a surgical operation, could the thought be introduced that you could be in the wrong. A hypodermic syringe would be too weak an instrument to effect such a radical change in you. Everyone else may be in the wrong. You? Never. As for me, I cannot get young Hattersley out of my head." "And I," retorted Julia with asperity, for her aunt's words had stung her, "I, for my part, do not give him a thought." She had hardly spoken the words before a chill wind began to pass around her. She drew the barouche shawl that she had over her bare shoulders and said, "Auntie, is the glass down on your side?" "No, Julia, why do you ask?" "There's such a draught." "Draught? I do not feel one. Perhaps the window on your side hitches." "Indeed, that is all right. It is blowing harder and is deadly cold." "Can one of the front panes be broken?" "No, Rogers would have told me had that been the case. Besides, I can see that they are sound." The wind of which Julia complained swirled and whistled about her. It increased in force. It plucked up her shawl and slew it about her throat. It tore at the lace on her dress. It snatched at her hair. It wrenched it away from the pins. The combs that held it in place, one long tress, was lashed across the face of Miss Fleming. Then the hair, completely released, eddied up above the girl's head, and the next moment was carried as a drift before her, blinding her. Then a sudden explosion as though a gun had been fired into her ear, and with a scream of terror she sank back among the cushions. Miss Fleming, in great alarm, pulled his check string and the carriage stopped. The footman descended from the box and came to the side. The old lady drew down the window and said, "Oh, Phillips, bring the lamp. Something has happened to Miss Demont." The man obeyed and sent a flood of light into the carriage. Julia was lying back, white and senseless. Her hair was scattered over her face, neck, and shoulders. The flowers that had been stuck in it, the pins that had fastened it in place, the pads that had given shape to the convolutions lay strewn, some on her lap, some in the rug at the bottom of the carriage. "Phillips," ordered the old lady in great agitation, "tell Rogers to turn the horses and drive home at once. And do you run as fast as you can for Dr. Crate." A few minutes after the carriage was again in motion, Julia revived. Her aunt was chafing her hand. "Oh, aunt," she said, "are all the glasses broken?" "Broken? What glasses?" "Those of the carriage with the explosion."
"Explosion, my dear?"
"Yes. That gun, which was discharged, it stunned me."
"Were you hurt?"
"I heard no gun, no explosion."
"But I did. It was as though a bullet had been discharged into my brain. I wonder that I escaped. Who can have fired at us?"
"My dear, no one fired. I heard nothing. I know what it was. I had the same experience many years ago. I slept in a damp bed and awoke stone deaf in my right ear. I remained so for 3 weeks. But one night, when I was at a ball and was dancing all at once, I heard a report as of a pistol in my right ear, and immediately heard quite clearly again. It was wax."
"But, Aunt Elizabeth, I have not been deaf."
"You have not noticed that you were deaf?
Oh, but look at my hair. It was that wind that blew it about."
"You are laboring under a delusion, Julia. There was no wind."
"But look, feel how my hair is down."
"That has been done by the motion of the carriage. There are many ruts in the road." They reached home, and Julia, feeling sick, frightened, and bewildered, retired to bed. Dr. Crate arrived, said that she was hysterical, and ordered something to soothe her nerves. Julia was not convinced. The explanation offered by Miss Fleming did not satisfy her. That she was a victim to hysteria, she did not in the least believe. Neither her aunt, nor the coachman, nor Phillips had heard the discharge of a gun. As to the rushing wind, Julia was satisfied that she had experienced it. The lace was ripped as by a hand from her dress, and the shawl was twisted about her throat. Besides, her hair had not been so slightly arranged that the jolting of the carriage would completely disarrange it. She was vastly perplexed over what she had undergone. She thought and thought, but could get no nearer to a solution of the mystery. Next day, as she was almost herself again, she rose and went about as usual. In the afternoon, the Honorable James Lawler called and asked for Miss Fleming. The butler replied that his mistress was out making calls, but that Miss Demont was at home, and he believed was on the terrace. Mr. Lawler at once asked to see her. He did not find Julia in the parlor or on the terrace, but in the lower garden to which she had descended to feed the goldfish in the pond. "Oh, Miss Demont," said he, "I was so disappointed not to see you at the ball last night."
"I was very unwell. I had a fainting fit and could not go. It threw a damp on our spirits, that is to say, on mine. I had you booked for several dances.
You were able to give them to others, but that was not the same to me. I did an act of charity and self-denial. I danced instead with the ugly Miss Burgones and with Miss Pounding, and that was like dragging about a sack of potatoes. I believe it would have been a jolly evening but for that shocking affair of young Hattersley, which kept some of the better sort away. I mean those who knew the Hattersleys. Of course, for me, that did not matter. We were not acquainted. I never spoke with a fellow.
You knew him, I believe?
I heard some people say so, and that you had not come because of him. The supper for a subscription ball was not atrociously bad."
"What did they say of me?"
"Oh, if you will know that you did not attend the ball because you liked him very much and were awfully caught up.
What a shame that people should talk. I never cared to rush for him. He was nice enough in his way, not a bounder, but tolerable as young men go. Mr. Lawler laughed. I should not relish to have such a qualified estimate made of me. Nor need you. You are interesting. He became so only when he has shot himself. It will be by this alone that he will be remembered. But there is no smoke without fire. Did he like you much? Dear Mr. Lawler, I am not a clairvoyant, and never was able to see into the brains or hearts of people, least of all of young men. Perhaps it is fortunate for me that I cannot. One lady told me that he had proposed to you. Who was that? The potato sack? I will not give her name. Is there any truth in it? Did he? No. At the moment she spoke, there sounded in her ear a whistle of wind, and she felt like a current, like a cord of ice, creep round her throat, increasing in force and compression. Her hat was blown off, and next instant a detonation rang through her head as though a gun had been fired into her ear. She uttered a cry and sank upon the ground. James Lawler was bewildered. His first impulse was to run to the house for assistance. Then he considered that he could not leave her lying on the wet soil, and he stooped to raise her in his arms and to carry her within. In novels, young men perform such a feat without difficulty, but in fact, they are not able to do it, especially when the girl is tall and big-boned. Moreover, what in a faint is a dead weight. Lawlord staggered under the burden to the steps. It was as much as he could perform to carry her up to the terrace, and there he placed her on a seat. Panting and with his muscles quivering after the strain, he hastened to the drawing room, rang the bell, and when the butler appeared, he gasped, "Miss Demont has fainted. You and I and the footman must carry her within." "She fainted last night in the carriage," said the butler. When Julia came to her senses, she was in bed, attended by the housekeeper and her maid. A few moments later, Miss Fleming arrived. "Oh, aunt, I have heard it again."
"Heard what, dear?"
"The discharge of a gun."
"It is nothing but wax," said the old lady. "I will drop a little sweet oil into your ear and then have it syringed with warm water."
"I want to tell you something in private." Miss Fleming signed to the servants to withdraw. "Aunt," said the girl, "I must say something. This is the second time that this has happened. I'm sure it is significant. James Lawler was with me in the sunken garden, and he began to speak about James Hattersley. You know, it was when we were talking about him last night that I heard that awful noise. It was precisely as if a gun had been discharged into my ear. I felt as if all the nerves and tissues of my head were being torn, and all the bones of my skull shattered. Just what Mr. Hattersley must have undergone when he pulled the trigger. It was an agony for a moment, perhaps, but it felt as if it lasted an hour. Mr. Lawler had asked me point blank if James Hattersley had proposed to me, and I said no. I was perfectly justified in so answering, because he had no right to ask me such a question. It was an impertinence on his part, and I answered him shortly and sharply with a negative. But actually James Hattersley proposed twice to me. He would not accept the first refusal, but came next day bothering me again, and I was pretty curt with him. He made some remarks that were rude about how I had treated him, and which I will not repeat. And as he left, in a state of that great agitation, he said, "Julia, I vow that you shall not forget this, and you shall belong to no one but me, alive or dead." I considered this great nonsense, and did not accord it another thought. But really, these terrible annoyances, this wind and the burst of noise, do seem to me to come from him. It is just as though he felt a malignant delight in distressing me, now that he is dead. I should like to defy him, and I will do it if I can. But I cannot bear more of these experiences. They will kill me. Several days elapsed. Mr. Lawler called repeatedly to inquire, but a week passed before Julia was sufficiently recovered to receive him, and the visit was one of courtesy and of sympathy, and the conversation turned upon her health and on indifferent themes. But some few days later it was otherwise. She was in the conservatory alone, pretty much herself again, when Mr. Lawler was announced. Physically, she had recovered, or believed that she had, but her nerves had actually received a severe shock,
She had made up her mind that the phenomena of the circling wind and the explosion were in some mysterious manner connected with Hattersley. She bitterly resented this, but she was in mortal terror of a recurrence, and she felt no compunction for her treatment of the unfortunate young man, but rather a sense of deep resentment against him. If he were dead, why did he not lie quiet and cease from vexing her? To be a martyr was to her no gratification, for hers was not a martyrdom that provoked sympathy and which could make her interesting. She had hitherto supposed that when a man died there was an end of him, his condition was determined for good or for ill, but that a disembodied spirit should hover about and make itself a nuisance to the living had never entered into her calculations. "Julia, if I may be allowed so to call you," began Mr. Lawler, "I have brought you a bouquet of flowers. Will you accept them?" "Oh," she said as he handed the bunch to her, "how kind of you. At this time of the year they are so rare, and our aunt's gardener is so miserly that he will spare me none for my room, but some miserable bits of geranium. It is too bad of you wasting your money like this upon me." "It is no waste, if it affords you pleasure." "It is a pleasure. I dearly love flowers." "To give you pleasure," said Mr. Lawler, "is the great object of my life. If I could assure you happiness, if you will allow me to hope, to seize this opportunity now that we are alone together." He drew near and caught her hand. His features were agitated, his lips trembled. There was earnestness in his eyes. At once a cold blast touched Julia and began to circle about her and to flutter her hair. She trembled and drew back. That paralyzing experience was about to be renewed. She turned deadly white and put her hand to her right ear. "Oh, James, James," she gasped, "do not, pray do not speak what you want to say, or I shall faint. It is coming on. I am not yet well enough to hear it. Write to me and I will answer. For pity's sake, do not speak it." Then she sank upon a seat, and at that moment her aunt entered the conservatory. On the following day a note was put into her hand, and containing a formal proposal from the Honorable James Lawler, and by return of post Julia answered with an acceptance. There was no reason whatever why the engagement should be long, and the only alternative mooted was whether the wedding should take place before Lent or after Easter. Finally it was settled that it should be celebrated on Shrove Tuesday. This left a short time for the necessary preparations. Miss Fleming would have to go to town with her niece concerning a trousseau, and a trousseau is not turned out rapidly any more than an armed cruiser. There is certainly a certain period allowed to young people who have become engaged to see much of each other, to get better acquainted with one another, to build their castles in the air, and to indulge in little passages of affection, vulgarly called spooning. But in this case, the spooning had to be curtailed and postponed. At the outset, when alone with James, Julia was nervous. She feared a reoccurrence of those phenomena that so affected her. But although every now and then the wind curled and soughed about her, it was not violent, nor was it chilling, and she came to regard it as a wail of discomfiture. Moreover, there was no reoccurrence of the detonation, and she fondly hoped that with her marriage the vexation would completely cease. In her heart was deep down a sense of exultation. She was defying James Hattersley, and setting his prediction at naught. She was not in love with Mr. Lawler. She liked him in her cold manner, and was not insensible to the social advantage that would be hers when she became the Honorable Mrs. Lawler. The day of the wedding arrived. Happily it was fine. "Blessed is the bride, the sun shines on," said the cheery Miss Fleming. "An omen, I trust, of a bright and unruffled life in your new condition." All the neighborhood was present at the church. Miss Fleming had many friends. Mr. Lawler had fewer present, as he belonged to a distant county. The justice path had been laid with red cloth, the church decorated with flowers, and a choir was present to twitter "The Voice That Breathed O'er Eden." The rector stood by the altar, and two cushions had been laid at the chancel step. The rector was to be assisted by an uncle of the bridegroom, who was in holy orders. The rector, being old-fashioned, had drawn on pale gray kid gloves. First arrived the bridegroom with his best man, and stood in a nervous condition, balancing himself first on one foot, then on the other, waiting, observed by all eyes. Next entered the procession of the bride, attended by her maids, to the wedding march, and Lohengrin on a wheezy organ. Then Julia and her intended took their place at the chancel step for the performance of the first portion of the ceremony, and the two clergy descended to them from the altar. Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife? I will. Wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband? I will. I, James, take thee, Julia, to my wedded wife, to have and to hold. And so on. As the words were being spoken, a cold rush of air passed over the clasped hands, numbing them, and began to creep round the bride and to flutter her veil. She set her lips and knitted her brows. In a few minutes she would be beyond the reach of these manifestations. When it came to her turn to speak, she began firmly, I, Julia, take thee, James. But as she proceeded, the wind became fierce. It raged about her, it caught her veil on one side and buffeted her cheek. It switched the veil about her throat as though strangling her with a drift of snow contracting into ice, but she persevered to the end. Then James Lawler produced the ring and was about to place it on her finger with the prescribed words, with this ring I thee wed, when a report rang in her ear, followed by heaving of her skull, as though the bones were being burst asunder, and she sank unconscious on the chancel step. In the midst of profound commotion, she was raised and conveyed to the vestry, followed by James Lawler, trembling and pale. He had slipped the ring back into his waistcoat pocket. Dr. Crate, who was present, hastened to offer his professional assistance. In the vestry, Julia rested in a Glastonbury chair, white and still, with her hands resting in her lap, and to the amazement of those present was seen that on the third finger of her left hand was a leaden ring, rude and solid, as though fashioned out of a bullet. Restoratives were applied, but full a quarter of an hour elapsed before Julia opened her eyes and a little color returned to her lips and cheek. But as she raised her hand to her brow to wipe away the damps that had formed on it, her eye caught sight of the leaden ring, and with a cry of horror she sank again into insensibility. The congregation slowly left the church, awestruck, whispering, asking questions, receiving no satisfactory answers, forming surmises all incorrect. I am very much afraid, Mr. Lawler, said the rector, that it will be impossible to proceed with the service today. It must be postponed till Miss Demont is in a condition to conclude her part and to sign the register. I do not see how it can be gone on with today. She is quite unequal to the effort. The carriage was to have conveyed the couple to Miss Fleming's house and then later to have taken them to the station for their honeymoon. The horses decorated with white rosettes, the whip adorned with a white bow, was now to convey Julia, hardly conscious, supported by her aunt, to her home. No rice could be thrown. The bell ringers prepared to give a joyous peal were constrained to depart. The reception at Miss Fleming's was postponed. No one thought of attending. The cakes, the ices, were consumed in the kitchen. The bridegroom was bewildered, almost frantic, ran hither and thither, not knowing what to do, what to say. Julia lay as a stone for fully 2 hours, and when she came to herself, could not speak. When conscious, she raised her left hand, looked at the leaden ring, and sank back again into senselessness. Not till late in the evening was she sufficiently recovered to speak, and then she begged her aunt, who had remained by her bed without stirring, to dismiss the attendants. She desired to speak with her alone. When no one was in the room with her save Miss Fleming, she said in a whisper, "Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, oh, Auntie, such an awful thing has happened. I can never marry Mr. Lawler, never. I've married James Hattersley. I am a dead man's wife." At that time that James Lawler was making the responses, I heard a piping voice in my ear, an unearthly voice, saying the same words. When I said, I, Julia, take you, James, to my wedded husband, you know Mr. Hattersley is James as well as Mr. Lawler. Then the words applied to him as much or as well as to the other, and then, when it came to the giving of the ring, there was the explosion in my ear as before, and the leaden ring was forced onto my finger and not James Lawler's golden ring. It is of no use my resisting any more. I am a dead man's wife and I cannot marry James Lawler. Some years have elapsed since that disastrous day and that incomplete marriage. Miss Demont is Miss Demont still, and she has never been able to remove the leaden ring from the third finger of her left hand. Whenever the attempt has been made, either to disengage it by drawing it off or by cutting through it, there has ensued that terrifying discharge as of a gun into her ear, causing insensibility. The prostration that has followed, the terror it has inspired, have so affected her nerves that she has desisted from every attempt to rid herself of the ring. She invariably wears a glove on her left hand, and it is bulged over the third finger where lies the leaden ring. She is not a happy woman. Although her aunt is dead and has left her a handsome estate, she has not got many acquaintances. She has no friends, for her temper is unamenable and her tongue is bitter. She supposes that the world, as far as she knows it, is in league against her. Towards the memory of James Hattersley, she entertains a deadly hate. If an incantation could lay his spirit, if prayer could give him repose, she would have recourse to none of these expedients, even though they might relieve her. So bitter is her resentment. She harbors a silent against Providence for allowing the dead to walk to molest the living.